Afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Scott Tucker from Chimkleys & Kellis. On behalf of the plaintiffs below appellees, I'd like to take this opportunity before the appellants start to introduce my co-counsel. With me today is Jeff Golan from Barrick, Rodas & Bassine and Julie Reiser from Cohen, Milstein & Sellers. Mr. Golan will be making the presentation today.
Welcome to the Court.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Scott Perkins of Richards, Leighton and Finger on behalf of the Countrywide Defendants below appellees. With me at council table today are Mr. Eric Roth and Mr. Stephen DePrima, both of Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen, and Katz. Mr. Roth has been admitted pro hoc vice, and with Your Honors' permission, will be presenting argument on behalf of the Countrywide Defendants.
Welcome.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Martin Lessner, Young Conway, Stargate, and Taylor on behalf of Appellee Bank of America. With me, I have my co-counsel, William Souchon, from the firm of O'Melveny & Myers.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Afternoon, Mr. Grant.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. This case, or this appeal, gives the Court an opportunity to address two problems. The first is what happens when one files a complaint in good faith and the facts don't pan out in discovery, whether the Delaware court should require the plaintiffs to do what's right and simply dismiss the case without prejudice, or are they going to be able to reach some kind of made-up disclosure settlement, get a little fee, and everything's great.
The issue is we can either do right or and rule against your opponents, or do wrong and rule against you. It's just that simple.
Every time I appeal, it's that simple, Your Honors. The second issue is releases in a disclosure case. Should a disclosure case release disclosure claims and nothing more, or should the law not tolerate this kind of settlement in which the sole consideration is disclosure and the release includes substantive damage claims? So I think those are the big issues, and I put them out there. But let me go back to the first point, and I think it's really important, because plaintiffs below readily admit that following discovery, they realized they had no case. And that's on pages 10 to 12 of their brief. Now, the correct thing to do is to dismiss without prejudice. And I will tell you, I've been, fortunately rarely, but I've been in that situation recently a few months ago in the IMS case in front of the chancellor. And we realized, although we pled a case in good faith, it was a deal case, we realized that when we took discovery, it wasn't there. And one should dismiss without prejudice. One should not find these little kinds of discovery issues and then say, okay, we'll reach some kind of, little kind of disclosure issues and reach some kind of settlement. Because what happens? The plaintiffs say, okay, well, we're going to trade away a valuable claim for their own benefit, meaning a fee. The defendant sees on this and they say, well, we realize that we can buy our way out of a big problem simply by putting in some minor disclosures and paying a small fee. So the defendants are happy, their counsel's happy, plaintiff's counsel is happy, and the problem is the shareholders get the short shrift. And this is what happens when individual plaintiffs who have minimal stakes in outcomes get to run the show. And in fact, that's what happened here. We tried to depose those plaintiffs, and we were blocked, and the Chancery Court would not order the depositions. So with the
disclosures that were made, the shareholders got to decide, didn't they,
whether they
would get the short
grift? In fact, that's something we agree upon. One of the things that both the defendants and plaintiffs told you here was this was a complete no-brainer, that Countrywide had to be acquired by Bank of America, and the shareholders had no choice. The directors had no choice. Conceivably, there could be a disclosure issue in which what is being asked to be disclosed is so critical, and the deal is so close, should I not vote for it? But here, everyone at this table tells you that this was the absolute no-brainer, that the plaintiffs say we had no case, they had to sell, defendants say we had to sell. So what do the disclosures do? I mean, I think that's what they call a Hobson's choice. You have a choice of one. You only have something to do. There's no judgment to be made here. So these few mini disclosures that were made were, in the words of the Vice Chancellor, although used in the wrong context, virtually worthless. But again, I point out that with almost no economic interest, the plaintiffs sell out, whereas my clients and my group of clients have 1.3 million shares And then there were lots and lots of other folks who weren't clients but who owned millions and millions and millions of shares who wrote to the court and said, we object to the settlement. We got nothing, and we're giving up claims. Now let's talk about how the Vice Chancellor erred. The Vice Chancellor erred by assuming that...
Mr. Grant, should we focus on the nature of the claims being given up? We're not talking about a recovery directly to shareholders here. We're talking about a derivative claim, correct?
Correct.
How would that play out?
Well, interesting. It's actually important because I think the Vice Chancellor got confused here.
Once a year, I get to ask an important question. This is it. This is your chance.
I'm excited because I'm ready for this one. The claims here, the extremely valuable claims, and I say extremely valuable because they were good claims against people who had money that could be sustained with the derivative claims. Now, that was an asset of the company, maybe their most important asset, given what happened to the company. Bank of America made clear that they have no interest in these claims. So the question is, do you take something that may be the company's most important asset and basically just say, well, we'll throw it in on the deal? And the Vice Chancellor said, well, you know, I can't really, you know, think about that. But that was the key here because, and this is kind of where it fits into to Gantler also, this is a unique situation, unique factual situation, not a unique legal situation, but unique fact situation, that these claims are claims against the directors themselves. So you have this kind of interest in it. And you'd say, well, what do we want fiduciaries to do? Should they say, okay, Bank of America, if you're really interested in all the loan business, everything else, but not these claims, and we want to get a higher price, but you've told us you won't negotiate over price. How about we take this thing that you think is worthless, that we think is worth a lot, we'll put it in a litigation trust, we'll distribute it to all the shareholders, and that'll be kind of the extra, you know, gravy. That'll be the thing that really seals the deal. Do they do that? No. Do they think about that? No. What do they do instead? The insiders negotiate with Bank of America for the most stringent reimbursement and indemnification provisions I think that you will see in any deal. So just when they had the opportunity to look after the shareholders and say, here's we're going to protect you, here's how we're going to get you extra money at a time that we don't have a whole lot of leverage, but we found something that is worth nothing to the acquirer and worth a lot to someone else, heck, I would have bought them. I think they're great claims. And instead, what they did was they negotiated, how can I protect myself? And that's where they breached their fiduciary duty. Now, those are not novel concepts like the court below said. It is an extremely novel factual situation, but not novel concepts. The concepts are very similar. Are very well known to Delaware law. The first is that you have to be looking out for the shareholders, not yourself as a director. And the second thing is when you have an asset, you have the obligation to maximize it. Now, the court below got confused and said, well, you know, you can't just go sell off everything in pieces. Sometimes it's better to sell it as a whole. Don't disagree with that. But when there is this extremely valuable asset that the buyer says is of no value to me, you at least have to explore, well, can I carve that out of the deal because it adds such great value?
Is it fair to characterize the Vice Chancellor's view as one of agreeing with you that it was a valuable asset, or did he consider in the nature of the settlement it to be virtually valueless?
Well, he didn't make the right calculation. The calculation that he had to make is what is being given up versus what is being received. And he focused on that the claim against B of A or the directors for not paying enough money was not a good claim because the plaintiff said it wasn't a good claim, the defendant said it wasn't a good claim, and I stood up and said, I don't know. It's just not my claim. So he looked at that as what was being given up and compared it to what are they getting? Well, gee, they got disclosures. And I think that's the wrong calculus. The calculus is...
He had to know about your derivative claims, right?
But he knew about it, but he didn't put it in the calculus. He needs to say, what are they giving up? And what they're giving up...
So the issue isn't that he disagreed with you on whether those claims had value or not. What he didn't do is include them at all or consider them at all. Is that what you're telling us?
I'm telling you the second half, not the first half. He didn't think that they had value because he said, well, the derivative claims might have value, but your claim that the directors breached their fiduciary duty because they didn't do anything to try to monetize that value or realize that value for the shareholders is a novel claim and therefore virtually worthless because you didn't provide me any case law that would support it. Well, I wasn't trying my case in front of him. When I get the opportunity, and I think right now the case is actually in the Central District of California, I will give all that case law of why I think it supports it. But what the court below did was he just said, well, those claims are derivative claims. The deal wipes those derivative claims out. And you're really trying to say, well, gee, you know, how do you resurrect them? And Delaware law doesn't allow that. And I submit that that is an incorrect statement of law, that it may be novel in the factual situation, but the premise of our complaint, that you have a duty to do what's best for the shareholders and not what's best for you personally, is well known to Delaware law. And I think he missed the point there. And when he was weighing things, he should have said, on one side of the scale, I have these disclosures, which are virtually worthless. Why are they virtually worthless? Because it's a Hobson's choice. You must take this deal. It's not a close choice that you need this information. On the other side, what are you giving up? You're giving up the ability to sue Bank America for and the director defendants for not paying a fair price. That's not worth anything, and that's what he looked at. But what he failed to say is, and the extremely broad release also gives up your ability to sue Angelo Mozzillo and the rest of the boys for all the damage that they did, and not taking that those claims and finding a way to keep them and add value to the shareholders. Just saying, hey, we'll throw them in to the pot with B of A, because we know B of A won't do anything. Why? Because we negotiated personally for our own indemnifications that would cover us. So first we're going to kill those derivative claims, and then we're going to make sure that nothing happens to them because we're going to get them to indemnify us. And that's what he missed. The second thing he got wrong was the burdens, because he turned to us and he said that, you know, you haven't proven to me that your claim is worthwhile. I would submit one that we had, even though there wasn't a, you know, the trial, the argument wasn't based on that. But number two, the other side has to show that it's fair. And so when they fail to show that it's fair, I don't really have to step up forward anything. And the court really focused on what did we show and what did we not show. And the other fundamental problem.
Did the court also say that it was fair?
The court ultimately concluded that we did not show that it was unfair and said in his own business judgment that he thought it was fair. And I think he's just plain wrong. And I think the other reason why he got that wrong was an error as a matter of law. He said because this is a stock-for-stock deal, the business judgment rule is going to apply, and therefore you'll never get past the business judgment rule and your claim's no good. And I submit that that was an error of law, that under Gantler, that this is one of those situations where the directors had interests that were very different and personal interests from the shareholders generally, and that even if it made sense for both the shareholders and the directors to do this deal with B of A, it didn't make sense to do it in the way they did it. It made sense for them for the shareholders to carve out these claims that B of A wouldn't pay anything for and make that the extra kicker for the shareholders. And failing to even think about that, let alone doing that, is where entire fairness comes in. And they have to be judged on their actions because they were self-interested in failing to look at that and failing to do it, failing to preserve those claims. That should have been governed under Gantler by entire fairness, and the court just missed that. And of course, in Ray Telecommunications, I think also supports that, where, you know, directors' interests significantly diverge from those of the countrywide equity holders generally, that would do that. Now, going back to what the chief talked about being right and wrong, the reason this is so important is if this settlement is affirmed, Angelo Mozzillo walks with stockholders never having their day in court to address their claims against him and his cohorts. That's what's critical about this. And this is a unique factual situation, not legal situation. He walks. And I submit that there's really one question that you have to ask yourself in order to decide this appeal. And it's not a very difficult question at all. It's not a legal question. If stockholders were put to the very simple question, which do you think they'd choose? Would you prefer the additional disclosures that you received in the proxy, or would you prefer an opportunity, no matter how long a shot, an opportunity to try to hold Angelo Mozzillo liable for the destruction of Countrywide? Which would you prefer? And I submit to your honors, it's not even close. If you put 100 shareholders in here, every one of them would say, I want to go after Mozzillo. Well, I want my day in court.
You're in your rebuttal time, so just maybe you can answer this question quickly. Is that really framing the question that the shareholders would be asked, though? Would it be at the risk of being acquired by BOA?
No, because they, when they were put with a choice, had they done what was right, had they carved this out and said, we're going to, you'll value these claims, B of A, we're going to put it in a litigation trust before you even buy us. We're going to distribute, you know, shares of this litigation trust to all the stockholders, and then we will sell you the active businesses, which is what you wanted. B of A's not walking anywhere.
And that's what you're saying, that the directors had a duty to do.
They had
to carve those assets out, put them in a litigation trust, not make them part of the merger deal before presenting it to the shareholders.
At a minimum, they had to think about that.
Well, let's say they thought about it and decided against it. What then?
I think the problem is they would have to then come before the court and show that that decision was entirely fair, because what they were being asked to do was sue themselves. And this was a very viable suit. We know because of Judge Felser's ruling that it's a very viable and valuable suit. And if they decided, no, I'm not going to do that.
Well, is the ruling you're talking about simply denying a motion to dismiss?
Yes. That's a hugely important thing in any case.
Well, I understand it's procedurally important. I'm just trying to get a grip on how it speaks to the value of the case.
It's economically important. As soon as that motion to dismiss is denied, the value of a case for settlement purposes is an enormous leap. It then will continue on.
Believe me, having spent 6 years on Chancery, I understand how the value of the case changes as a result of denying the motion to dismiss, but how does it affect the value of the claims themselves in terms of their merits rather than what it costs to settle litigation?
Well, from the plaintiff's perspective, which is how these claims would have been recovered, by the litigation trust's perspective, the more that they can be settled for, the more money there is for everyone. Now, I don't say we would settle right after this. I think we'd move forward. But clearly, these have significant value. I think they had significant value as soon as they were pled. I think they had even more value once the motion to dismiss was denied.
But that was post-merger agreement, right? The timing of the denial?
They were brought before then. Post the merger, there was the merger agreement, then there was the and then the decision, and then about 4 months, 3 months later, there was the settlement, and then it closed right after. And I'm saying that there was time either before that merger or after the merger and before the closing to carve that out, because B of A valued it at nothing.
If I understand your point, when the vice chancellor is looking at whether this is a fair and reasonable settlement and taking into consideration all that was on the table, he knew at that point that the motion to dismiss had been denied in California.
Exactly.
You want to save the balance of your time?
Please.
May it please the court, Jeffrey Golan of Barrick, Rodas & Bessine on behalf of lead plaintiffs appellees. It's a privilege to appear before your honors today. I think the starting point for this appeal is the Barkan decision, which says that, first of all, the review of this court of approval of a settlement is quite limited, and that if there is evidence in the record to support the chancellor's findings and his conclusions are not the product of errors of law, we must affirm the settlement approval. Here in this case, the vice chancellor had an extensive record that we developed throughout the case. We filed our consolidated complaint following the merger announcement in February of 2008. We obtained discovery. We looked at approximately 400,000 pages of documents, took depositions of the three senior executives at Countrywide, took depositions of their two financial advisors, took the deposition of the Bank of America representative who negotiated the merger, and took the deposition of the lead independent director of the Countrywide board. We got internal notes, we got internal emails, we got handwritten notes, board books,
and
all sorts of documents relating to the merger. And all of that showed that the price paid by Bank of America for Countrywide at the time of the merger was a fair price. And in fact, the appellants don't contest that it was a fair price. It was analyzed by the financial advisors to Countrywide who did discounted cash flows, which are included in the proxy that showed.
Why don't we get to the point where you and the appellant today disagree?
Okay. Where we disagree is that the appellants would have liked us to have required a specific set of claims to be not released through this settlement. They said that the board had a duty either to value the derivative claims that were then pending against the company's directors, or to hack those off and preserve them in a litigation trust, which was something that that the California court had denied in an opinion in March of 2008 in their California case.
The argument is that the directors should have done that at the pre-merger stage.
Yes, sir.
In negotiating the deal.
Yes, and the answer to that is twofold. First of all, the merger with Bank of America had become, by the end of 2007, a virtual necessity for this company. Had it issued its fourth quarter results, which would have shown a loss, they clearly would have gone below investment grade and probably faced liquidation. So the board, based on its financial advisors, negotiated the deal at the exchange ratio set with Bank of America. The assets, the contingent asset, which is what this derivative claim is, that the appellants think should have been either hacked away or valued over and above the fair price, came with contingent liabilities as well. Bank of America wasn't only negotiating to take assets of this company. It was taking liabilities and contingent liabilities. It took $21 billion of debt. It took
I thought what you were arguing was that when Bank of America acquired Countrywide, it acquired all the assets by operation of law, including the derivative claims.
It did.
And whether or not Bank of America chose to prosecute those claims was up to Bank of America, but those claims did not belong to the former shareholders. What they had, if anything, would be direct claims, but their direct claim, I assume, would be a claim that they did not, as a result of some breach of fiduciary duty, get sufficient value for their shares in the merger. And that is what that is what the proper focus of the settlement should have been.
The claim that's being made, as I understand it, is that there were derivative claims against the directors that had value to the company, and that by operation of law through the merger, those would accede to Bank of America. And in fact, this settlement didn't release those derivative claims. They're not part of the release. And as those claims devolved to Bank of America was also taking contingent liabilities that really arose based on the same alleged misconduct. There were state attorney general investigations going on, which ended up costing Bank of America.
Yeah, but we're not concerned here with Bank of America. We're concerned with the former shareholders or public shareholders of Countrywide.
And
if they have a claim after this transaction, it has to be that they did not receive sufficient value for their shares in the merger because, and I guess I'm making up the argument here for Mr. Grant, there was such an undervaluation or failure to evaluate the derivative claims in determining the merger price that it constituted a breach of fiduciary duty on the part of the directors in allowing that to happen.
And that is the claim that he is making, and that's the claim that the vice chancellor understood that he was making. But there were derivative claims that had been asserted in late 2007. There had been no motion to dismiss made at that point. And the directors were faced in early January with a situation where if they did not sell to Bank of America, they were looking at likely liquidation of the company once the fourth quarter results were issued, because they were going to issue at a loss for the fourth quarter. In that situation, they conducted a valuation of the company with their financial advisors, and the financial advisor, we took his deposition, and he testified that as of that time, there was no reasonable basis to assign a value to the derivative claims. They were not sufficiently either certain or estimable at that point. And instead, he conducted primarily a discounted cash flow that showed that the exchange ratio price, the $7 and change, that was agreed to in the merger was in fact above the and this is at in the proxy statement at page 40.
Now just make sure that's clear to me, when you use the phrase at that time, that would have been before the motion to dismiss had been denied in California.
Yes, sir. Yes, Your Honor. That
Do you agree with Mr. Grant that adds value to the claim, the mere fact that the motion to dismiss had been denied? Would that alter the expert's valuation of the derivative claims?
Well, we went ahead and asked our plaintiff's expert before we entered into the settlement, and this is in the record at tab 5. Now that the derivative claims have by and large passed a motion to dismiss, is it possible for you to value them? And our expert informed us that no, even at that point, they're not reasonably estimable and they wouldn't come into a discounted cash flow analysis. Of course, lawyers can assign all sorts of projected value to these claims, but in terms of the investment bankers and the financial advisors, even at the time of the merger and even at the time of our settlement, our expert could not opine that these had a reasonable value, and our expert also took the position with us and counseled us that they could not testify that the price paid in the merger was anything but fair.
I understand the merger price, but is that a factual issue on which reasonable experts could differ?
Well, that's an interesting question, Your Honor, because we raised when the appellants raised their objection to the preliminary approval of the settlement, there were a series of hearings with the vice chancellor, and throughout all those hearings, we raised the point that the appellant was not claiming that the price was unfair to shareholders. And in fact, at the settlement hearing, and this is at tab 11 of the appellant's appendix.
Well, my question was directed to the value of the claims in California after the motion to dismiss. Yeah. Is that something about which reasonable experts could differ over whether at that point an expert would be capable of evaluating them and putting a number on their?
It may be subject to expert a disagreement, but in this case, when the appellants presented their objection to the vice chancellor below, they submitted an expert affidavit that Mr. Miller, who discussed how a valuation may be done of those claims, but did not come to any conclusions that the claims had a certain value or even could be valued as of October 2008. So that in this case, in the record before the vice chancellor, there were no countervailing opinions either of the financial advisors to the board, the consultant, the litigation valuation consultant to the plaintiffs, or the expert that the appellants had retained for purposes of opposing the settlement.
Thank you very much.
I see my time is up. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Eric Roth of Wachtell Lipton for the Countrywide Defendants. In assessing the objector's arguments here, I think it's important to keep in mind the standard of review applicable to this appeal. This is obviously an appeal from an order granting approval of a settlement. The Vice Chancellor enjoys considerable discretion in determining whether or not a settlement is fair. And, of course, the scope of this Court's review of such a determination is limited. Essentially, it's an abuse of discretion standard. We don't believe the objectors came close to meeting that standard. The Vice Chancellor did precisely what this Court's precedents required him to do. He carefully assessed the claims both of the proponents, the named plaintiffs, and of the objectors, concluded that those claims were weak, and in the case of the objectors, that they were novel theories of whose probable validity was minimal and whose chances of success were poor. We believe that all of this is very much supported by the record. Let me begin quickly with this issue that Mr. Grant has raised with respect to the burden of proof, the notion that somehow the Vice Chancellor shifted the burden of proof to the objectors. With all due respect, I think that's an issue that lacks any support. The Vice Chancellor's opinion unambiguously states at page 15, the burden of persuading the Court that a settlement is fair and reasonable belongs to the settlement proponents. It is settled law in Delaware. The objectors must come forward with some evidence of their supporting their objection, but ultimately the burden of proof falls on the proponents. That burden was met here and met in spades with a substantial record, 9 depositions, 2 expert reports, and the key documents out of a 400,000 document set. But this is no different than Resorts International, where this Court, in affirming the Chancery Court's approval of a class action settlement, said, objectors failed to come forward with any evidence to rebut the business judgment rule's application to the challenged transactions. Same exact story here. This case didn't turn on burden of proof. The Vice Chancellor didn't find this to be a close case, 50-50, with the proponents winning just because the burden of he wrongfully decided the burden of proof was on them. The decision, it makes it quite clear. He found their claim. The record supported our view, and he approved the settlement as fair. Now, with respect to these claims and the so-called value, got to follow the bouncing ball here because the objectors sometimes use the phrase claims to refer to the derivative claims, sometimes to the direct claims that were released by this settlement. Those are two very different things, two very distinct things, and it can be confusing. The Vice Chancellor here did not abuse his discretion in concluding that the so-called duty to value and duty to preserve claims, the direct claims that were released by this settlement, were functionally worthless and had poor chances of success. Let's start with the duty to value. The Board did not attempt to value the derivative claims. That is a given. The Board also did not attempt to value any of the other billions of dollars of assets that Countrywide held, from the corporate art collection to the value of the corporate headquarters, that B of A might or might not be interested in. No Delaware court has ever imposed a duty on a Board to undertake a separate and discrete valuation of derivative claims or any other individual corporate asset. In Lewis versus Ward, this Court affirmed the dismissal of derivative suit for lack of standing following a merger where the derivative claims were wiped out by operation of law, Section 259, Lewis versus Anderson. In doing so, this Court observed at page 906 that the complaint did not allege that the AMAX Gold Board had even considered the plaintiff's derivative claims when it approved the merger. And there is not a hint of a discussion in that section of the opinion that the Board had somehow breached a duty by failing to value this one particular asset. This is not a case like Merit versus Colonial Foods, where you've got a squeeze-out merger, the acquirer is acquiring his own public company, in effect. He's on both sides of the deal and wiping out a derivative claim on the eve of trial. And Merit versus Colonial Foods also distinguishable because there was an issue as to the fairness of the price. The objectors had not said that the price was unfair. The vice chancellor correctly found they conceded as much. They don't just want a fair price. They want a fair price plus, a fair price plus the spinoff of derivative claims. Well, there are good policy reasons why Delaware courts should not impose a duty to value a derivative claim in the context of an arm's-length merger like this. First, look at the quality of the information that would be provided to shareholders if the law imposed such a duty. As noted, as the Vice Chancellor noted, derivative claims are not easily valued. And I would add that is particularly the case. It's a particularly dubious and imprecise exercise when the derivative claims are still in their incipiency. As Justice Ridgely pointed out, when the board sat there on January 10th and had to figure out whether or not to sell this company, whether to, and how to preserve value for the shareholders, the cases had begun, derivative cases, that is, only 6 weeks before. No discovery had taken place, no motion to dismiss had been made, and, of course, the operative complaint had not even been filed. That one didn't get filed until February of 2008, more than a month after the board met and approved the merger. And, of course, the motion to dismiss was decided ultimately 4 months later. Any valuation of a derivative claim that early in the game, before any of that has happened, is, frankly, Your Honors, a back-of-the-envelope guesstimate that, if disclosed, could be more misleading to shareholders than it would be helpful. And valuation like that takes time. Their own expert, the objectors acknowledged below, and I quote, potential damages that could be recovered in the derivative case would require an extensive analysis of the facts and presentation of expert reports, A662 of the appendix. Now, this board had no time. The facts, as the vice chancellor found them, were basically this. This company was about to go under. This was a company whose very lifeblood, the securitization of mortgage markets, had disappeared in August. They were living essentially on their creditors at the creditors' will. They were hoping to finance the company's operations through opening a bank that would take deposits from consumers. And there were imminent, there were bankruptcy rumors, and they were about to announce a fourth quarter loss, a credit rating downgrade. This board had no time. It acted quickly but prudently and got the shareholders the best deal they could at a 38% premium to the unaffected market price. Whatever value a duty to value claim might have in the abstract, on the record before him, the vice chancellor correctly concluded that here, on these facts, it was worthless. No evidence that B of A was willing to pay any more. The company was in extremis. The board had no bargaining leverage, not a shred of evidence. So had you, in some other case, if the court were inclined to impose a duty to value, maybe you could say it would get the shareholders something. On this record, the vice chancellor was absolutely correct in concluding that there was nothing to be, in consideration to shareholders would not be enhanced.
Well, I may have misunderstood Mr. Grant's argument, but I did not understand it to be that the duty was to get Bank of America to pay more. I thought the theory was, in the equitable sense, that since Bank of America thought it had no value, the board thought it had no value, nobody was negotiating around its value. There's no real evidence that it had any value. Just put it aside and let it go for what could be achieved in the California litigation. No harm, no foul to anyone.
Well, Your Honor, he advanced both theories, and I was disposing, I hope, of the duty to value theory. Now as to the duty to preserve, a separate cause of action that he dreamed up, this notion that one should place these derivative claims in some kind of litigation trust and spin them off to the shareholders and thereby create value. The vice chancellor also correctly concluded that these claims were worthless. There are no Delaware cases that impose any such obligation. Indeed, I submit this failure to preserve theory is plainly inconsistent with a long line of Delaware cases. It may not go all the way back to Thomas Spry, but it certainly goes back to Lewis versus Anderson in 1984. An acquired company's shareholder standing to sue is extinguished in a stock-for-stock merger. Under Section 259A of the Code, the acquired company gets that asset. Imposing a duty on the acquired company's board to strip this asset away from the acquirer and give it to the acquired company's shareholders can't be reconciled with 259A, or we submit the Lewis case. Now, the Lewis case has two exceptions, two equitable exceptions that this court created back in 1984. Derivative standing is retained where the merger is perpetrated solely to deprive the shareholders of standing or where the merger is in reality a reorganization. They know they can't meet that standard. They didn't even try to meet that standard. They concede the merger wasn't pretextual.
Your time's up, but I want to ask you a question.
Sorry.
Isn't their argument one that recognizes that's the current state of the law, but in effect what the appellant is doing is asking us to add a third equitable exception given the novel, unique factual situation here?
That charitably, that may be what he's asking Your Honor to do. In Lewis versus Ward, Your Honors adhered to the Lewis versus Anderson exceptions of 1984, saw no reason to revisit them. I submit that imposing this new duty in the context of a approval of a settlement, and one other thing, this is not an unusual case. It's not an unusual case. There are many, many companies that have derivative claims pending that are then the subject of mergers. It happens in the banking world now every day of the week. It is a very, very common occurrence. Now, is there a duty? Is Delaware law going to impose a duty on the acquired company's board, contrary to Lewis versus Anderson, to create litigation trusts? Think of what the serious legal complexities that flow from such a decision.
Well, we don't, unfortunately, have time to explore all of those, but we'll review the brief and take your policy argument into consideration.
Thank you, Your
Honor.
Thank
you very much.
Appreciate your time.
Your Honors, to correct a few things that were said, both Mr. Golan and Mr. Roth talked about the extensive record of the case before the Vice Chancellor. There wasn't an extensive record. Even though they talked about 9 depositions, expert reports, 400,000 pages, that was in the case that plaintiff said, we have no case. There was no extensive record about my case in California that was being given up because of the release here.
Let me just ask you a question about that. I understand Judge Fowler denied the motion to dismiss the securities action or the derivative action in May of 08. Is that right?
I thought it was March.
All right. It was before the merger.
Well before the merger, yes.
Okay. Is it correct that the shareholders were told of that ruling?
Yes.
In the proxy materials?
Correct.
So if there was merit to the argument that the federal court's denial of the motion to dismiss enhanced the value of those claims, that was a fact that the shareholders were able to take into account in deciding whether or not to approve the merger.
Were they physically able to take into account? Yes. Did it make a difference if you say, look, we're going to lose the whole business because it's going down the tubes, but there is this, you know, billion-dollar asset out there that the directors aren't doing anything to preserve for you? There's nothing you can do. You got to vote to take your sure, you know, $5 right now rather than doing that. But that's not what the law requires. The law doesn't force the shareholders to do that. The law, which I think is fairly old and established law, is what would an unconflicted person do handling his own affairs? What would someone like that in that position do? And I use the example, if you were to sell a house and you negotiated with the buyer and you sold the house and there happened to be furniture in there, and you then went to the buyer and said, hey, would you give me anything for the furniture? And he says, no, it's of no use to me. Would a person say, well, then I'm just going to leave all the furniture there and walk? Would they at least think about it? I think they'd say, no, if you're not going to give anything to me, then let me see how I can get some value for it. You know, I'll sell it to someone. I'll give it away to Goodwill and get the tax deduction. I'll do something. That's what a fiduciary has to do. What would you do if you were unconflicted and you were dealing with your own property?
Thank you, Mr. Grant. Thank you. Thank you very much, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement. Adjourn.
Right.